When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. John Muir.
Blue Dot, Episode 12. Tyler Nordgren, The National Parks, and The Dark Night Sky.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem.
And I'm Matt Schiltz, and we're talking to a guy that's got some of your favorite things, Dave, that he's all about.
Yeah, he's totally in my wheelhouse. The national parks as the crown jewels of nature in our country and the precious disappearing resource of darkness, the dark night sky. The ability to see stars at night, it's imperiled by the glow of our artificial lighting.
Yeah, and he'll tell us a little bit about why that actually is an issue.
Yeah, our guest is Tyler Nordgren. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Redlands in Southern California. He's also an artist. His passion is using the national parks as places to get in touch with, as Carl Sagan so eloquently put it, nature on the grandest scale. Dr. Nordgren was part of a team that developed the Mars dials, special sundials used to calibrate the cameras on the Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity rovers on Mars. He uses his passion for the night sky to do public outreach education for public and staff at the national parks. He's also the author of Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. Tyler, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Tell us how you forged this relationship between your love of astronomy and the national parks. Which came first, your love of astronomy or the national parks?
Oh, I've loved astronomy ever since I was a small kid. I wanted to be an astronaut when I was 7. And so I planned out college and my career from the moment I used to send away letters to NASA back there in 1977. So I always knew I wanted to be an astronomer. In fact, I got my PhD at Cornell University studying dark matter, and I was a full professor out here at the University of Redlands. And when I got my first digital camera, I decided to celebrate and go camping up in Yosemite National Park. And when I was up there, I went to the Evening Ranger program, just like most everybody does. And it was a ranger talking about the night sky and what the Park Service was doing to preserve these dark, starry vistas for the public. And since it was in an outdoor amphitheater, as it got darker, people would look up and they'd see the stars and they were oohing and aahing. And I mean, it's not too silly to say that that moment changed the path of my career at that moment. And I thought, well, this is something I want to get involved with.
I mentioned in the opening the Mars dials. I'd just like to touch on that for a moment. Could you explain to us exactly what they are and their purpose?
Sure. Well, I was a graduate student when I was at Cornell, and one of my professors, I was actually his TA, was Steve Squires. He was the principal investigator for Spirit and Opportunity, the first two rovers that NASA sent up in 2003. And on each of these rovers, and now Curiosity, is what's called a color calibration target. It's this little target that allows the cameras to calibrate the various filters, the various color filters. And it's a little square plaque with a stick, with a post in the middle. And on the square plaque are four different regions of different colors and some concentric circles of grays and whites and blacks. And with that post, you get to see what these colors look like in the Martian daylight and in Martian shadow. And if you think about it, when you're here on Earth and you take a photograph with your camera, you know the color is balanced if the sky turns out to be blue and the trees are green. But on Mars, there's none of those color cues. And so we had to have something on the spacecraft that we knew what it should look like under laboratory settings, laboratory light conditions. And Bill Nye, he's the science guy, was talking to Steve one day and said, well, that's a sundial. And so we got together a group of about 6-7 of us, artists and astronomers, to turn these rather dry calibration targets into working sundials. And so there's the name of Mars in 16 different languages engraved on there. There's a message from the children of Earth. And like all sundials, there's a date and a motto. And ours is Two Worlds, One Sun. And so those are sitting up on Mars right now. And one of the team members, Woody Sullivan at the University of Washington, constructed computer overlays that would go on top, allow you to see what the local time and even the season was on Mars.
Now, speaking of Mars, in your work, you like to try to find analogs in the national parks. Where are some of the places that are analogous to Mars that people can visit in the national park system?
Well, I just got back from Death Valley National Park that held their third annual Mars Fest, and it was an opportunity for NASA scientists to travel to the park and meet with the public, give talks and field trips showing how places like Death Valley could be a great analog for what the conditions on Mars might be like. And what we're getting at is a number of things. The geology, for instance. You've got a very dry location with lots of rocks, many of which were created from volcanic processes. And there's, in fact, a hill there in the park called Mars Hill, because as you walk across it, there are these little boulders all over the hill, these little volcanic basalt boulders that look exactly like what you might find on Mars. And it's one of the places that NASA's actually tested its Mars rovers to see if they could traverse and how they would handle the conditions. But there's also astrobiology. In one of these incredibly dry locations, down at the very lowest part of Death Valley, you have these salt flats. And in these salt flats, it looks like the most inhospitable place you could ever find. But if you cut down in and lift up a section of salt, and by the way, for the public, don't do this, but if you were to lift up this salt, you could see a layer of actual plant life, microbial life, down there buried underneath this harsh outer layer. And so it allows us to think, well, how might life actually adapt to the harsh conditions we find on other planets?
One of the ways I became familiar with you is when I saw one of your posters at Lassen Volcanic National Park, and it said, "Half the park is after dark." And it's a beautiful image that recalls back to the origin of the Park Service in the 30s. Could you tell us a little bit about how you developed that style and some of the posters you've made for the Park Service?
So when I first started working with the park, after I had my aha moment of listening to them talk about these dark, starry skies and what the Park Service was doing to help preserve them, I wound up spending my sabbatical, a full calendar year, traveling through the parks, working with park rangers and visitors on ways to help promote the dark, starry skies, this natural nocturnal vista that people have when they go out there. And one of the things that struck me is there's so much history that's wrapped up in the parks, 100 years, as a matter of fact, this year. And so those old 1930s WPA posters that encouraged people to get out and see America, and those doors were created during the Great Depression. And at the time that I was doing my travels through the parks, it was at the start of the Great Recession back in 2008. And so it felt right. Let's take this moment to tell people that, hey, come out to the parks, camp for a night, see something beautiful, something that helps put just the world and our problems in perspective. And while the parks on the ground have preserved the landscape by day, because of their protections, they've preserved the starry sky overhead by night. So come out here and see the Milky Way. And that and the tagline, "Half the park is after dark," really came out of that experience. And I love that style of art, and so I tried drawing a generic poster, and as park rangers found out about this, they said, "Well, could you draw one for us?" And what started as the single poster and a comment that I'd given my talks about how this was our, maybe wouldn't it be wonderful if this could be a new campaign, well, it actually did turn into a new campaign. And at this point, there's something like, I'd say, well over 50 See the Milky Way posters for parks all over the country.
Real quick, for somebody listening to this that would like to check them out, maybe while they're listening, what's the website where they can see your work?
You can go to tylernordgren.com. I'm the only Tyler Nordgren astronomer out there, and at tylernordgren.com, I've put really all the posters that I've helped create for the Park Service, including some of these terrestrial analog ones. They're the planetary park posters, and even some for the solar eclipses that have been visible in the parks and that will be. It's been a wonderful way of reaching out to the public and reaching out to the parks.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom. And if you're just joining us, our guest is Tyler Nordgren. We're talking about science in general and astronomy in particular in the national parks. The great quote by John Muir, when you try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. The night sky really is part of the wilderness experience of visiting a national park. Could you explain how you feel about that?
We go to the national parks by day in order to, you know, breathe clean air and see calming sights and glimpse this universe around us that we have here on Earth, to see wildflowers and wildlife and waterfalls. And when the sun goes down, that view of our universe doesn't change. We get the opportunity to see the universe beyond our own atmosphere, in the Milky Way and the stars overhead and the planets and the moon. And this is a part of our universe that we've allowed to slip away in our daily lives here in cities and towns. And unfortunately, it's happened so slowly that we've kind of failed to notice that we've lost it until we get out to the national parks and the sun goes down and people see the sight that is now almost all but impossible. Two-thirds of the U.S. population no longer lives someplace where the Milky Way is even faintly visible. And so that's what the parks afford. And it's a natural hand-in-hand part of what the parks are preserving. And so for myself, one of the things I love is to go out at night with my camera, and I can go to these places that by day may be shoulder-to-shoulder with photographers like Delicate Arch at Arches National Park in Utah. And at night, I have the place to myself. And so it even makes me think of what it was like to be in the parks back in the 1930s, and back when people weren't yet there in their droves by day.
A lot of us here in the North State can see the Milky Way, so we don't necessarily think of it as an endangered resource. So explain why this is something worth protecting.
Okay. Well, when I was a child, one of the questions I had for my parents was, well, how many stars are there in the sky? And it was one of those things I'd go out on a dark night and try to count the stars. And as a small kid, usually I'd fall asleep. And I think that might have been my parents' plan. But where I live here in the greater Los Angeles sprawl, the answer to that question of how many stars are there in the sky has an answer. And that answer is 12. And odds are one of those stars is probably an airline on its way into LAX. So when you live someplace and millions of people, half the world's population now lives in urban areas, when you live in a place like that and there's only 12 stars in the sky, there's no longer any reason to look up. There's nothing up there to see. And when you don't look up and you don't see even the planets, while they might be faintly visible, you wouldn't know which one of those things up there is one. So if you don't look up, you don't ask any questions. Astronomy and the sky and the stars don't instill any curiosity. And so as a scientist, that's where scientists come from, those aha moments in children where they wonder about the universe above them. Well, that stops happening. And at the same time, when you lose the stars, well, imagine if on a smoggy day, smog rolls in and you can't see the forest or Mount Shasta, the Sierra Nevada or the Cascades. If by day you were to lose the world around you and it was nothing but a gray haze, you'd feel that you'd lost something. And for a lot of people, about roughly 50% of the world's population, we've lost that view at night. We are wrapped in an orange haze of our own creation.
And it's not necessary, is it?
It's not. And that's the thing that's so aggravating and that I help try to spread the message of. We think about these lights at night that are blotting out the stars. We think of them as necessary for safety. And so it becomes this issue of safety versus stars. But it doesn't have to be. If you put shades on your lamps so that the only light travels downward, well, downward is where you need that light. It's down here on Earth where we have cars that we have to watch out for, pedestrians crossing streets, or people that might do us harm. When light shines upward into the sky, all it's doing is lighting up the sky. And unless you're afraid of some sort of giant mutant bat sweeping out of the sky to carry off your children, there's no reason to be lighting that sky up.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Tyler Nordgren on the national parks and the dark night sky. And we're back talking to Tyler Nordgren, professor of physics and astronomy at Redlands University in Southern California. We're talking about the national parks and the dark night sky. You mentioned this earlier. I saw your posters promoting the Great American Eclipse of 2017. A lot of people are not aware that we're about to have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity here in North America. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Well, back in 1979 was the last time a total solar eclipse touched the continental United States. And that happens when the moon passes directly in the sun. And if you are right there in the path of totality, you will see the sky grow dark, the temperature drop, the sun turn black, the bright stars come out, and this ghostly corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, will suddenly come into view. It's the only time it ever does. And so it's this multi-sensory experience, like the birds stop chirping. And I can say, in all honesty, as somebody who has spent my entire life looking at the sky, a total solar eclipse is the most awe-inspiring thing I have ever seen in my life. It is the most unnatural, natural, astronomical experience you'll ever have. So in 2017, this is going to happen again. The shadow of the moon is going to sweep across the Earth, directly across the United States from Oregon down to South Carolina. And there are something like 15 million people that will be living directly in the path of that shadow diagonally across the United States. And we are a group of astronomers, including myself, are working to let people know that on August 21st, 2017, go outside, look at the sun. During the partial phase, you'll need special solar eclipse glasses. They cost about $1. But when totality happens, take those glasses off, and it will be perfectly safe to have this awe-inspiring, mind-blowing experience. And for those people that don't live within that path, do everything in your power to take the drive, to make your way into the path. You will not regret this.
Are any of the parks in the path?
Yes, there are several parks. The big one is going to be Grand Tetons National Park in Wyoming. They are directly along the path of totality. In the eastern United States, it's going to be Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And then there's a number of smaller monuments across the country. John Day Fossil Beds National Monument up in Oregon is one. Craters of the Moon, I think, in Idaho is possibly another that has part of it. So there's a number of places that people can go, but really anywhere. Get yourself into that path, out into the countryside, and since total solar eclipses happen when the moon passes in front of the sun, it's around those days that the moon is not up at night, and so the nights are as dark as possible. So if you're up someplace like, say, Wyoming or Idaho or eastern Oregon, go for the sun, stay for the stars. You'll see the Milky Way at night. So it's really a win-win situation for everyone.
We live in a time where more and more people are spending their time staring at screens, and they can see awesome things there, like pictures from the Cassini orbiter at Saturn or the Curiosity rover on Mars or images from the space telescopes like Hubble. But I think you can't get a true sense of awe that way. What do you think about that in terms of being outside in a place like one of our national parks?
I agree with that. I've stood in Big Bend National Park down in West Texas. It's one of the darkest parks I've ever visited. And it's the only place I've ever stood where at night there was no trace that the electric light bulb had been invented. You couldn't even see some distant glow of light from a city over the horizon. And when I was down there, it was in March, and on a moonless night, I saw the Milky Way rise over 180 degrees around the horizon. And it was mesmerizing. At the moment as it was rising, I realized that it was circling the horizon and that I was standing straight up in the Milky Way and that my gaze was looking out across the disk of our galaxy of 100 billion stars. And if I were to raise my arms, my right arm would be pointing in the direction that we were traveling around the galaxy, and my left arm was pointing to where we'd come from. And it was just absolutely incredible. At that instant, I knew exactly where I was in the universe. And I actually felt a sense of vertigo, as if I could fall up into that great vastness of stars overhead. And I felt like my toes needed to grip the earth to keep me from falling off. And I'm a very reasonable astrophysicist. I know that wouldn't happen. But that instant, it was like this battle between knowing and feeling. And if that can happen to me, then that can happen to anyone. And get out there and feel that for yourself. There is no way you can feel that from a computer monitor.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom, along with Matt Schultz, and our guest is Tyler Nordgren. We're talking about the dark night sky and our national parks.
Hey, Tyler, you're one of these people who combines science and nature and art, and it's sort of this, you know, these three sides of you. And I'm just wondering how that came about. Like, was it all three at once? Did something feed into the other? How do these three things develop?
Well, somewhere in college and eventually graduate school, my desire to be an astronaut changed to a desire to be an astronomer, because I loved the science. I loved learning about what is out there. Why are there pulsars, and how big is our galaxy, and what is dark matter? And my first job out of graduate school was the U.S. Naval Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, where we were building a special telescope that actually could see the surfaces of other stars and watch them expand. And on days when I wasn't working, I was there in Flagstaff, and I had the whole Four Corners area and Grand Canyon and the Painted Desert, and I would go out exploring. And I'd never really spent any time out in the desert. And when you'd get out there, and then the sun would set, and you'd have stars from horizon to horizon, I realized that I was getting this chance to see these things that I'd always been studying. And so whereas I've known astronomers that could spend an entire night, say, looking at Jupiter on their telescope, on their telescope monitor, but yet couldn't go outside and actually tell which one of those stars in the sky was Jupiter, I, on the other hand, I love being able to go out and say, ah, that constellation right there, my galaxies are right there in between those three stars. And when I realized that there's so much astronomy and planetary science that if you really understand it, it's there on display for anybody to see, particularly in places like the national parks, that's where I had my aha moment of, this is what I can do to share it with the public. Give the people a place to go out and actually get that eyes-on view and see it for themselves.
I'd like to ask you, it's a tough question, I want to ask you what your favorite park is, although you can answer that if you like. What are some of your favorite experiences that you've had recently in the national parks?
Well, when I spent my year traveling through the parks, one of the things that rangers would ask me as they heard about what I was doing, they'd say, oh, well, so what is your favorite park? And in all honesty, I was always able to say, well, it's the park I'm at right now. And that's kind of the way I feel. I've had some magical moments. I mentioned the one out in Big Bend National Park. Another park that I absolutely love is Chaco Culture National Historical Park. It's in northwestern New Mexico, and it's a small park, and their big claim to fame are these enormous great houses, these 1,200-year-old pueblos built by the folks we used to call the Anasazi, but today we call them the Chacoans or the ancestral Puebloan people. And there are a number of these have astronomical alignments to them. And I find it to be a breathtaking place, especially because you've got about 12 miles of dirt road to get out there. And so as you're driving there, you just feel the years dropping away until you get out in this lonely place with this one little campground, and you can actually feel like what it must have been like to be out there 1,200 years ago. And so that's one of my favorites. Every year is a new adventure, and I continue to take my camera along and try to capture what the Milky Way and what the sky looks like over these parks. And that's where the art has had a chance to come out. That and drawing the posters, it's something I've always enjoyed, and so it allows me to exercise that other half of my sort of my background, my artistic side.
We're about out of time, but real quick, give a pitch out there. Somebody listening right now, never been to a national park, convince them to go.
The national parks are a treasure. I've traveled all over Europe. I've been to historical locations there, and you go, it's maybe a cathedral, and there's nobody there to help you just explore what it is. But you go to a national park, you see the granite face of El Capitan, and there's a ranger there who will tell you about its history, its geology, and maybe she'll take you on a hike. Perhaps it'll be a moonlit hike to see the rainbow cast by the moon in a waterfall during June in Yosemite. No other country does this. And when that sun sets and the Milky Way comes out, you will hear people with languages from all over the world talking beside you as everyone realizes that this is a special place. There's something unique here. See it now, because only by seeing it now will the Park Service continue to preserve this, and will we continue to have this for future generations.
Tyler, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
We've been talking to Tyler Nordgren, physics and astronomy professor, artist, and author of the book Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. Well, Matt, I'm inspired to go out and visit a national park and stay up all night and look at the night sky.
Absolutely, looking at the night sky and see some of the parks that we haven't seen before, because like you said, every park you're in is your favorite park. And then I can't wait till next summer when we have the total solar eclipse.
Total solar eclipse, the great American solar eclipse, going to be the best opportunity of all of our lifetimes to see one without having to travel halfway around the world and spend, you know, a bazillion dollars to do it.
I think we'll have to do another show on that.
We certainly will be paying attention to that in the near future. One other thing he said that struck me was, and this is so true, when you go to a national park, you know, it can be kind of crowded when you visit some of the places, like, for example, at Lassen Park, if you go to Bumpus Hill or you're climbing Mount Lassen. But if you go out at night, you know, just walk around the campground, go out in the forest a little bit, at nighttime, you just feel that all aloneness that's just wonderful, just the solitude. Thanks for joining us. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom. And I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.